Chapter 9. The company at Westcliff's table had been relieved by the news that Beatrix had elected to spend the rest of the evening alone in quiet contemplation. No doubt they feared another interruption by yet some other pocket-sized pet, but Amelia had assured them there would be no more unexpected visitors at the table. Only Lady Westcliff had seemed genuinely perturbed by Beatrix's absence. The Countess excused herself somewhere between the fourth and fifth courses, and reappeared after a quarter hour. Amelia later learned that Lady Westcliff had sent for a supper tray to be brought to Beatrix in the library, and had visited her there.
"Lady Westcliff told me a few stories of when she was a girl, and how she and her younger sister used to misbehave," Beatrix recounted the next day. "She said bringing a lizard to supper was nothing compared to the things they had done. In fact, she said they were both diabolical and rotten to the core. Isn't that wonderful?"
"Wonderful," Amelia said sincerely, reflecting on how much she liked the American woman, who seemed relaxed and fun-loving. Westcliff was another matter. The Earl was more than a little intimidating. And after Leo's callous dismissal of Westcliff's concerns over the Ramsay tenants, it was doubtful the Earl would be kindly disposed toward the Hathaways. Thankfully, Leo had managed to steer clear of further controversies during supper, mostly because he had been drawn into flirtation with the attractive woman beside him. Although women had always been beguiled by Leo, with his height and good looks and intelligence, he had never been as ardently pursued as he was now.
"I think it says something odd about women's tastes," Wynne told Amelia privately, as they stood in the Ramsay House kitchen, "that Leo wasn't chased by nearly as many women when he was nice. It seems the more odious he is, the more they like him."
"They're welcome to have him," Amelia replied grumpily. "I fail to see the appeal of a man who goes through each day looking as if he's either just gotten out of bed or is preparing to get back in it."
She wrapped her hair in a protective cloth and tucked the ends under turban style. They were preparing for another day of cleaning, and the ancient house dust had a tendency to cling obstinately to the skin and hair. Since Leo was still abed after a night of heavy drinking, and probably wouldn't arise until noon, Amelia was feeling particularly cross with him. It was Leo's house and estate. The least he could do was help restore it.
"His eyes have changed," Wynne murmured. "Not merely the expression, the actual colour. Have you noticed?"
Amelia went still. She took a long time to reply.
"I thought it was my imagination." "No, they were always dark blue like yours. Now they're mostly light grey. Like a pond after the sky has turned in winter."
"I'm certain the colour of some people's eyes change as they mature."
"You know it's because of Laura."
A heaviness pressed against Amelia from all sides, as she thought about the friend she had lost, and the brother she seemed to have lost along with her. But she couldn't dwell on any of that now. There was too much to be done.
"I don't think such a thing is possible. I've never heard of—"
She broke off as she saw Wynne wrapping her long braids in a cloth identical to hers.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm going to help today," Wynne said.
Although her tone was placid, her delicate jaw was set like a mule's.
"I'm feeling quite well and—"
"Oh, no, you're not. You'll work yourself into a collapse, and then you'll take days to recover.
Just find some place to sit while the rest of us—" "I'm tired of sitting. I'm tired of watching everyone else work. I can set my own limits, Amelia. Let me do as I wish."
"No."
Incredulously, Amelia watched as Wynne picked up a broom from the corner.
"Wynne, put that down and stop being silly."
Annoyance whipped through her. Wynne was not going to help anyone by expending all her reserves on menial tasks.
"I can do it," Wynne insisted,
gripping the broom handle with both hands, as if she sensed Amelia was on the verge of wrenching it away from her.
"I won't overtax myself."
"Put down the broom."
"Leave me alone," Wynne cried.
"Go dust something."
"Wynne, if you don't—"
Amelia's attention was diverted, as she saw her sister's gaze fly to the kitchen threshold. Merripen stood there, his broad shoulders filling the doorway. Although it was early morning, he was already dusty and perspiring, his shirt clinging to the powerful contours of his chest and waist. He wore an expression they knew well, the implacable one that meant one could move a mountain with a teaspoon sooner than to change his mind about something. Approaching Wynne, he extended a broad hand in a wordless demand. They were both motionless, but even in their stubborn opposition, Amelia saw a singular connection, as if they were locked in an eternal stalemate from which neither wanted to break free. Wynne gave in with a helpless scowl.
"I have nothing to do."
It was rare for her to sound so peevish.
"I'm sick of sitting and reading and staring out the window. I want to be useful. I want—"
Her voice trailed away as she saw his stern face.
"Fine, then. Take it."
She tossed the broom at Merripen, and he caught it reflexively.
"I'll just find a corner somewhere and quietly go mad. I'll—"
"Come with me," Merripen interrupted calmly. Setting the broom aside, he left the room. Wynne exchanged a perplexed glance with Amelia.
"What is he doing?"
"I have no idea."
The sisters followed him down a hallway to the dining room, which was spattered with rectangles of light from the tall, multi-paned windows that lined one wall. A scarred table ran down the centre of the room, every available inch covered with dusty piles of china, towers of cups and saucers, plates of assorted sizes sandwiched together, bowls wrapped in tattered scraps of grey linen. There were at least three different patterns all jumbled together.
"It needs to be sorted," Merripen said, nudging Wynne toward the table. "Many pieces are chipped. They must be separated from the rest."
It was the perfect task for Wynne, enough to keep her busy, but not so strenuous that it would exhaust her. Filled with gratitude, Amelia watched as her sister picked up a teacup and held it upside down. The husk of a tiny dead spider dropped to the floor.
"What a mess," Wynne said, beaming. "I'll have to wash it too, I suppose."
"If you'd like Poppy to help," Amelia began.
"Don't you dare send for Poppy," Wynne said. "This is my project, and I won't share it."
Sitting at a chair that had been placed beside the table, she began to unwrap pieces of china. Merripen looked down at Wynne's turbaned head, his fingers twitching, as if he was sorely tempted to touch a blonde tendril that had slipped from beneath the cloth. His face was hard, with the patience of a man who knew he would never have what he truly wanted. Using a single fingertip, he pushed a saucer away from the edge of the table. The china rattled subtly across the battered wood. Amelia followed Merripen back to the kitchen.
"Thank you," she said when they were out of her sister's hearing. "In my worry over making certain Wynne didn't tire herself, it hadn't occurred to me that she might go mad from boredom."
Merripen picked up a heavy, clattering box of discarded odds and ends and hoisted it to his shoulder with ease. A subtle smile crossed his face.
"She's getting better."
He strode to the door and shouldered his way outside. It was hardly an informed medical opinion, but Amelia was certain he was right. Looking about the dilapidated kitchen, she felt a surge of happiness. It had been the right thing to come here, a new place offering new possibilities. Perhaps the Hathaways' bad luck had finally changed. Armed with a broom, mop, dustpan, and a stack of rags, Amelia went upstairs to one of the rooms that hadn't yet been explored. She used her full weight to open the first door, which gave way with a cracking sound and a shriek of unoiled hinges. It appeared to be a private receiving room, with built-in wood bookcases. There were two volumes on one shelf. Examining the dust-coated books, their aged leather covers shot with spidery cracks, Amelia read the first title, "Fine Angling, a Symposium on the Fisherman's Art, with much on roach and pike." No wonder the book had been abandoned by its previous owner, she thought. The second title was far more promising, amorous exploits of the Court of England in the reign of King Charles II. Hopefully it would contain some ribald revelations she and Wynne could giggle over later. Replacing the books, Amelia went to open the shrouded windows. The drapery's original colour had faded to grey, their velvet nap ragged and moth-eaten. As Amelia laboured to pull one drape to the side, the entire brass rod came loose from the ceiling and clattered heavily to the floor. A cloud of dust enveloped her, and she sneezed and coughed in the clotted air. She heard an inquiring shout from downstairs, probably from Merripen.
"I'm all right," she called back.
Picking up a clean rag, she wiped her face and unlatched the filthy window. The casing stuck. She pushed hard against the frame to loosen it. Another push, harder, and then a determined shove with all her weight behind it. The window gave way with astonishing suddenness, unsettling her balance. She pitched forward and caught the edge of the window in an attempt to find purchase, but it swung outward. In the flash of forward-falling panic, she heard a muffled sound behind her. Before another heartbeat had passed, she was snatched, pulled back with such force that her bones protested the abrupt reversal of momentum. She staggered, fetching hard against something solid and yet supple. Helplessly she tumbled to the floor in a tangle of limbs, some of them not her own. Sprawled over a sturdy masculine chest, she saw a dark face below her, and she muttered in confusion, "Merry!" But these were not Merripen's sable eyes. They were light, glowing amber. A jolt of pleasure went through her stomach.
"You know, if I have to keep rescuing you like this," Tam Rowan remarked casually, "we really should discuss some kind of reward."
He reached up to tug off her hair covering, which was askew, and her braids tumbled down. Mortification swept away every other feeling. Amelia knew how she must look, dishevelled and dust-stippled. Why did he never miss an opportunity to catch her at a disadvantage? Gasping out an apology, she struggled to get off him, but the weight of her skirts and the stiffness of her corset made it difficult.
"No, wait."
Rowan inhaled sharply as she squirmed against him, and he rolled them both to their sides.
"Who let you into the house?" Amelia managed to ask.
Rowan gave her an innocent glance.
"No one. The door was unlocked, and the entrance hall was empty."
He kicked his legs free of her clinging skirts and pulled her to a sitting position. She had never known anyone who possessed such ease of movement, almost feline in nature.
"Have you had this place inspected?" he asked. "The house is ready to fall off its timbers. I couldn't risk coming in here without offering a quick prayer to Butyakengo."
"Who?"
"Her gypsy protective spirit."
He smiled at her.
"But now that I'm here, I'll take my chances. Let me help you up."
He tugged Amelia to her feet, not letting go until her balance was secured.
"Why are you here?"
she asked. Rowan shrugged.
"Just paying a call. There isn't much to do at Stony Cross Park. It's the first day of fox hunting season."
"You didn't want to take part?" He shook his head.
"I only hunt for food, not sport. And I tend to sympathize with the fox, having been in his position once or twice."
He must have been referring to a gypsy hunt, she thought, with concern and curiosity. She wanted to ask about it. But no, this conversation could not continue.
"Mr. Rowan," she said awkwardly, "I wish I could be a proper hostess and show you to the parlour and offer refreshments, but I don't have refreshments. I really don't even have a parlour. Please excuse me for sounding rude, but this isn't a good time to call."
"I can help you."
He leaned a shoulder against the wall, smiling.
"I'm good with my hands."
There was no innuendo in his tone, but her colour deepened nonetheless.
"No, thank you. I'm sure Butyakengo would disapprove."
"Butyakengo."
Anxious to demonstrate her competence, Amelia strode to the other window and began jerking at the closed draperies.
Thank you, Mr. Rowan, but as you can see, I have the situation well in hand.
I think I'll stay. Having just stopped you from falling through one window, I'd hate for you to go out the other.
I won't. I'll be fine. I have everything under...
She tugged harder, and the rod clattered to the floor, just as the other had done. But unlike the other curtain, which had been lined with aged velvet, this one was lined with some kind of shimmering, rippling fabric. Some kind of... Amelia froze in horror. The underside of the curtain was covered with bees. Bees! Hundreds, no, thousands of them, their iridescent wings beating in an angry, relentless hum. They lifted in a mass from the crumpled velvet, while more flew from a crevice in the wall, where an enormous hive simmered. The insects swarmed like tongues of flame around Amelia's paralyzed form. She felt the blood drain from her face.
Oh, God!
Don't move.
Rowan's voice was astonishingly calm.
Don't swat at them.
She had never known such primal fear, welling up from beneath her skin, leaking through every pore. No part of her body seemed to be under her control. The air was boiling with them. Bees and more bees. It was not going to be a pleasant way to die. Closing her eyes tightly, Amelia willed herself to be still, when every muscle strained and screamed for action. The air moved in sinuous patterns around her, tiny bodies touching her sleeves, hands, shoulders.
"They're more afraid of you than you are of them,"
she heard Rowan say. Amelia highly doubted that.
"These are not frightened bees."
Her voice didn't sound like her own.
"These are furious bees."
"They do seem a bit annoyed,"
Rowan conceded, approaching her slowly.
"It could be the dress you're wearing. They tend not to like dark colours."
A short pause.
"Or it could be the fact that you just ripped down half their hive."
"If you... have the nerve to be amused by this!"
She broke off and covered her face with her hands, trembling all over. His soothing voice undercut the buzzing around them.
"Be still. Everything's fine. I'm right here with you."
"Take me away!"
she whispered desperately. Her heart was pounding too hard, making her bones shake, driving every coherent thought from her head. She felt him brush a few inquisitive insects from her hair and back. His arms went around her, his shoulder hard beneath her cheek.
"I will, sweetheart. Put your arms around my neck."
She groped for him blindly, feeling sick and weak and disoriented. The flat muscles at the back of his neck shifted as he bent toward her, gathering her up as easily as if she were a child.
"There," he murmured. "I've got you."
Her feet left the floor, and she was floating and cradled at the same time. Turning her face into his shoulder, she let him carry her. His breath fell in a warm, even rhythm on the curve of her cheek.
"Some people think of the bee as a sacred insect,"
he told her.
"Its presence in your home is a sign of good things to come."
Her voice was buried in the fine wool of his coat.
"What does it mean if there are thousands of bees in one's home?"
He shifted her higher in his arms, his lips curving gently against the cold rim of her ear.
"Probably that we'll have plenty of honey for tea time. We're going through the doorway now. In a moment I'm going to set you on your feet."
Amelia kept her face against him, her fingertips digging into the layers of his clothes.
"Are they following?"
"No. They want to stay near the hive. Their main concern is to protect the queen from predators."
"She has nothing to fear from me."
There was a catch of laughter in his throat. With extreme care, he lowered Amelia's feet to the floor. Keeping one arm around her, he reached with the other to close the door.
"There. We're out of the room. You're safe."
His hand passed over her hair.
"You can open your eyes now."
Clutching the lapels of his coat,
Amelia waited for a feeling of relief that didn't come. Her heart was racing too hard, too fast. Her chest ached from the strain of her breathing. Her lashes lifted, but all she could see was a shower of sparks. Amelia.
Easy. You're all right.
His hands chased the shivers that ran up and down her back.
Slow down, sweetheart.
She couldn't. Her lungs were about to burst. No matter how hard she worked, she couldn't get enough air. Bees. The sound of buzzing was still in her ears. The sparks danced and collided, and when they faded, there was nothing around her but layers of grey softness. She sank into the quiet billows without a sound. After what could have been a minute or an hour, pleasant sensations filtered through the haze. A tender pressure moved over her forehead. The gentle brushes touched her eyelids, slid to her cheeks. Strong arms held her against a comfortingly hard surface, while a clean, salt-edged scent tickled her nostrils. Her lashes fluttered, and she turned into the warmth with confused pleasure.
"There you are," came a low murmur.
Opening her eyes, Amelia saw Cam Rowan's face above her. They were on the hallway floor. He was holding her in his lap. As if the situation weren't mortifying enough, the front of her bodice was gaping, and her corset was unhooked. Only her crumpled chemise was left to cover her chest. Amelia stiffened. Until that moment, she had never known there was a feeling beyond embarrassment that made one wish one could crumble into a pile of ashes.
My dress.
You weren't breathing well. I thought it best to loosen your corset.
I've never fainted before,
she said groggily, struggling to sit up.
You were frightened.
His hand came to the center of her chest, gently pressing her back down.
Rest another minute.
His gaze moved over her pale features.
I think we can conclude you're not fond of bees.
I've hated them ever since I was 7.
Why?
I was playing out of doors with Wynne and Leo, and I stumbled too close to a rose bush. A bee flew at my face and stung me right here.
She touched a spot just below her right eye, high on the crest of her cheek.
The side of my face swelled until my eye closed. I couldn't see from it for almost 2 weeks.
His fingertips smoothed over her cheek, as if to soothe the long-ago injury.
And my brother and sister called me Cyclops.
She watched him struggle not to smile.
They still do whenever a bee flies too near.
He regarded her with friendly sympathy.
Everyone's afraid of something.
What are you afraid of?
Ceilings and walls, mostly.
She stared at him in puzzlement, her thoughts still coursing too slowly.
You mean you would rather live outside, like a wild creature?
Yes, that's what I mean. Have you ever slept outside before?
On the ground?
Her bewildered tone made him smile.
On a pallet beside a fire?
Amelia tried to imagine it, lying undefended on the hard ground, at the mercy of every creature that crawled, crept, flew.
I don't think I could fall asleep that way.
She felt his hand playing slowly in the loose locks of her hair.
You could.
His voice was soft.
I would help you.
She had no idea what he meant by that, and she was afraid to speculate. All she knew was that as his fingers reached her scalp, she felt a sensual shiver run down her spine. Clumsily she reached for her bodice, trying to pull the reinforced fabric together.
Let me do that. You're still unsteady.
His hands brushed hers aside, and he began to hook her corset deftly. Clearly he was familiar with the intricacies of a woman's undergarments. Amelia didn't doubt there had been more than a few ladies willing to let him practice. Flustered, she asked,
"Was I stung anywhere?"
"No."
Mischief flickered in his eyes.
"I checked thoroughly."
Amelia suppressed a little moan of distress. She was tempted to push his hands away from her, except that he was restoring her clothing far more efficiently than she would have. She closed her eyes, trying to pretend she wasn't sprawled in a man's lap, while he fastened her corset.
"You'll need a local beekeeper to remove the hive,"
Rowan said. Thinking of the enormous colony in the wall, Amelia asked, "How will he kill them all?"
"He may not have to. If possible, he'll sedate them with smoke and transfer the queen to a movable frame hive. The rest will follow. But if he can't manage that, he'll have to kill the colony with soap water. The larger problem is how to remove the comb and the honey. If you don't take it all out, it will ferment and attract all kinds of pests."
Her eyes opened, and she looked up at him in worry. "Will the entire wall have to be removed?" Before Rowan could reply, a new voice entered the conversation.
"What's this?"
It was Leo, who had just arisen from bed and pulled on his clothes. He came barefoot from the direction of his bedroom. His bleary gaze moved over the pair of them.
"Why are you on the floor with your buttons undone?"
Amelia considered the question.
"I decided to have a spontaneous tryst in the middle of the hallway with a man I hardly know."
"Well, try to be more quiet about it next time. A fellow needs his sleep."
Amelia stared at him quizzically.
"For heaven's sake, Leo, aren't you worried that I may have been compromised?"
"Were you?"
"I..."
Her face turned hot as she glanced into Rowan's vivid topaz eyes.
"I don't think so."
"If you're not sure about it,"
Leo said,
"you probably weren't."
He came to Amelia, sank to his haunches, and stared at her steadily. His voice gentled.
"What happened, sis?"
She pointed an unsteady finger at the closed door.
"There are bees in there, Leo."
"Bees? Good God!"
Her brother gave her an affectionately mocking smile.
"What a coward you are, Cyclops."
Amelia scowled, levering herself upward from Rowan's lap. He braced her automatically, his arm firm behind her back.
"Go see for yourself."
Leo sauntered lazily to the room, opened it and stepped inside. In 2 seconds he had sped out, slammed the door, and lodged his shoulders against it.
"Christ!"
His eyes were wide and glazed.
"There must be thousands of them." "I'd estimate at least 200,000,
Rowan said. Finishing the last of Amelia's buttons, he helped her to her feet.
"Slowly,"
he murmured.
"You might be a bit light-headed."
She let him support her while she assessed her uncertain balance.
"I'm all right now. Thank you."
Her hand was still clasped in his. Rowan's fingers were long and graceful, the thumb band gleaming against honey-coloured skin. Uneasily, Amelia drew her hand away and told her brother,
"Mr. Rowan saved my life twice today. First I nearly fell out the window, and then I found the bees."
"This house," Leo muttered, "should be torn down and used for matchsticks." "You should order a full structural inspection,"
Rowan said.
"The house has settled badly. Some of the chimneys are leaning, and the entrance hall ceiling is sagging. You've got damaged joinery and beams. I know what the problems are."
The calm appraisal had annoyed Leo. He'd retained enough of his past architectural training to assess the house's condition accurately.
"It may not be safe for the family to stay here. But that's my concern,"
Leo said, adding with a sneer,
"Isn't it?"
Sensitive to the brittle disquiet in the atmosphere, Amelia made a hasty attempt at diplomacy.
"Mr. Rowan, Lord Ramsay is convinced the house poses no immediate danger to the family."
"I wouldn't be so easily convinced,"
Rowan replied.
"Not with 4 sisters in my charge. Care to take them off my hands?"
Leo asked.
"You can have the lot of them."
He smiled without amusement at Rowan's silence.
"No? Then pray don't offer unwanted advice."
Despondent worry swept over Amelia as she saw the bleakness of her brother's face. He was becoming a stranger, this man who harboured despair and fury so deep inside that it had begun to eat at his foundations, until, like the house, he would eventually collapse as the weakest parts of the structure gave way. Unruffled, Rowan turned to Amelia.
"In lieu of advice, let me offer some information. 2 days hence there'll be a mop fair held at the village.
What is that?
It's a hiring fair, attended by all the local residents in need of work. They wear tokens to signify their trade. A servant girl will carry a mop, a thatcher carries a tuft of straw, and so forth. Give the ones you want a shilling to seal the contract, and you'll have them for a year's employment.
Amelia darted a cautious glance at her brother.
We do need servants, Leo.
Go, then, and hire whomever you please. I don't give a damn.
Amelia gave a troubled nod, and raised her hands to her upper arms, rubbing them over her sleeves. It was cold, she thought, even for autumn. Icy draughts crept around her stockinged ankles, beneath the edges of her cuffs, across the sweat-dampened back of her neck. Her muscles tensed against the strange, raw chill. Both men had fallen silent. Leo's face was blank, his gaze focused inward. It felt as if the space around them was folding in on itself, thickening until the air was as heavy as water. Colder, tighter, closer. Instinctively, Amelia stepped back, away from her brother, until she felt Rowan's chest against her shoulders. His hand came up to her arm, gently cupping her elbow. Shivering, she leaned harder against the warm, vital strength of his body. Leo had not moved. He waited, his gaze unfocused, as if he were intent on absorbing the chill, as if he welcomed it, wanted it. His averted face was harsh and shadow-crossed. Something divided the space between them, she and Leo. She felt the resonance of movement, softer than a breeze, more delicate than eiderdown. Leo, Amelia murmured uncertainly. The sound of her voice seemed to bring him back to himself. He blinked and stared at her with near colourless eyes.
Show Rowan out, he said curtly. That is, if you've been sufficiently compromised for one day.
He walked away rapidly. Reaching his room, he closed the door with a clumsy swipe of his arm. Amelia was slow to move, bewildered by her brother's behaviour, and even more so by the splintering coldness in the hallway. She turned to face Rowan, who was staring after Leo with a level, thoughtful gaze. He glanced down at her, keeping his expression carefully impassive.
I hate to leave you.
There was a gently mocking edge to his tone.
You need someone to follow you around and keep you safe from mishaps. On the other hand, you also need someone to find a beekeeper.
Realizing he was not going to talk about Leo, Amelia followed his lead.
Will you do that for us? I would consider it a great favor.
Of course. Although, his eyes held a wicked glitter. As I mentioned before, I can't keep doing favors for you with no reward. A man needs incentive.
If you want money, I'll be glad.
God, no.
He was laughing now.
I don't want money.
Reaching out, he smoothed back her hair, letting the heel of his hand graze the edge of her cheekbone. The brush of his skin was light and erotic, causing her to swallow hard.
Goodbye, Miss Hathaway. I'll see myself out.
He flashed a smile at her and advised,
Stay away from the windows.
On the way down the stairs, Rowan passed Merripen, who was ascending at a measured pace. Mary Penn's face darkened at the sight of the visitor.
What are you doing here? It seems I'm helping with pest eradication. Then you can begin by leaving,
Mary Penn growled. Rowan only grinned nonchalantly, and continued on his way. After informing the rest of the family about the perils of the upstairs parlour, which was promptly dubbed the Bee Room, Amelia investigated the rest of the upstairs with extreme caution. There were no more hazards to be found, only dust and decay and silence. But it was not an unwelcoming house. When the windows were opened and light spilled across floors that had been untouched for years, it seemed the place was eager to open and breathe and be restored. Ramsay House was a charming place, really, with eccentricities, secret corners, and unique features that only needed some polish and attention, not unlike the Hathaway family itself.
In the afternoon, Amelia collapsed in a chair downstairs, while Poppy made tea in the kitchen.
"Where is Wynne?"
"Napping in her room," Poppy replied. "She was exhausted after the busy morning. She wouldn't admit it, of course, but you can always tell when she gets all pale and drawn."
Was she content?
She certainly seemed to be.
Pouring hot water into a chipped pot filled with tea leaves, Poppy chatted about some of her discoveries. She had found a lovely rug in one of the bedrooms, and after she had beaten it for an hour, it had turned out to be richly coloured and in good condition. "I think most of the dust was transferred from the carpet to you," Amelia said. Since Poppy had covered the lower half of her face with a handkerchief during the carpet beating, the dust had settled on her forehead, eyes, and the bridge of her nose. When the handkerchief was removed, it had left Poppy's face oddly two-toned, the top half grey, the lower half white.
"I enjoyed it immensely," Poppy replied with a grin. "There's nothing like whacking a carpet with a rug beater to vent one's frustrations."
Amelia was about to ask what Poppy's frustrations were when Beatrix entered the kitchen. The girl, usually so lively, was quiet and downcast.
"Tea will be ready soon,"
Poppy said, busy slicing bread at the kitchen table.
"Will you have some toast too, Bee?"
"No, thank you. Not hungry."
Beatrix sat in a chair beside Amelia's, staring at the floor.
"You're always hungry," Amelia said.
"What's the matter, dear? Aren't you feeling well? Are you tired?" Silence. A violent shake of her head. Beatrix was definitely upset about something. Amelia settled a gentle hand on her youngest sister's narrow back and leaned over her.
"Beatrix, what is it? Tell me. Are you missing your friends? Or Spot? Are you—"
"No, it's nothing like that."
Beatrix ducked her head until only the reddened arc of her cheek was visible.
"Then what?"
"Something's wrong with me."
Her voice roughened with misery.
"It's happened again, Amelia. I couldn't help myself. I barely remember doing it. I—"
"Oh, no,"
came Poppy's whisper. Amelia kept her hand on Beatrix's back. "Is it the same problem as before?" Beatrix nodded.
"I'm going to kill myself," she said vehemently. "I'm going to lock myself in the bee room. I'm going to—"
"Hush. You'll do no such thing."
Amelia rubbed her rigid back.
"Quiet, dear, and let me think for a moment."
Her worried gaze met Poppy's over Beatrix's down-bent head. The problem had occurred on and off for the past 4 years, ever since the Hathaways' mother had died. Every now and then, Beatrix suffered an irresistible impulse to steal something, either from a shop or someone's home. Usually the objects were insignificant. A tiny pair of sewing scissors, hairpins, a pen nib, a cube of sealing wax. But every so often she took something of value, like a snuff box or an earring. As far as Amelia could tell, Beatrix never planned these small crimes. In fact, the girl often wasn't even aware of what she had done until later. And then she suffered an agony of remorse, and no small amount of fear. It was alarming to discover one wasn't always in control of one's actions. The Hathaways kept Beatrix's problem a secret, of course, all of them conspiring to return the stolen objects discreetly and protect her from the consequences. Since it hadn't happened for nearly a year, they had all assumed Beatrix was cured of her odd compulsion.
"I assume you took something from Stony Cross Manor," Amelia said with forced calm. "That's the only place you visited."
Beatrix nodded miserably.
"It was after I let Spot go. I went to the library and looked in a few rooms on the way, and I didn't mean to, Amelia. I didn't want to.
I know."
Amelia wrapped her arms around her in a consoling hug. She was filled with a maternal instinct to protect, soothe, ease.
"We'll fix it, Bee. We'll put everything back and no one will know. Just tell me what you took, and try to remember which rooms the things came from."
"Here, this is everything."
Reaching into the pockets of her pinafore, Beatrix dumped a small collection of objects in her lap.
Amelia held up the first item. It was a carved wooden horse, no bigger than her fist, with a silk mane and a delicately painted face. The object was worn from much handling, and there were teeth marks along the horse's body. "The Westcliffs have a daughter, still quite small," she murmured. "This must belong to her."
"I took a toy from a baby," Beatrix moaned. "It's the lowest thing I've ever done. I should be in prison."
Amelia picked up another object, a card with two similar images printed side by side. She guessed it was meant to be inserted into a stereoscope, a device that would merge the two images into a dimensional picture. The next stolen item was a household key, and the last... oh dear. It was a sterling silver seal, with an engraved family crest on one end. One would use it to stamp a blob of melted wax and close an envelope. The object was heavy and quite costly, the kind of thing that was passed down from generation to generation.
"From Lord Westcliff's private study,"
Beatrix muttered.
"It was on his desk. He probably uses it for his official correspondence. I'll go hang myself now."
"We must return this immediately," Amelia said, passing a hand over her dampening brow. "When they realize it's missing, a servant may be blamed." The three women were silent with horror at the thought.
"We'll pay a morning call to Lady Westcliff,"
Poppy said, sounding a bit breathless from anxiety.
"Is tomorrow one of her receiving days?"
"It doesn't matter," Amelia said, striving to sound calm. "There's no time to wait. You and I are calling tomorrow, whether or not it's a proper day."
"Shall I go too?"
Beatrix asked. "No." Both Amelia and Poppy answered simultaneously. They were both thinking the same thing, that Beatrix might not be able to control herself during another visit.
"Thank you."
Beatrix seemed relieved.
"Although I'm sorry you have to undo my wrongs. I should be punished somehow. Perhaps I should confess and apologize."
"We'll resort to that if we're caught," Amelia said. "First, let's try covering it up."
"Do we have to tell Leo or Wynne or Merripen?"
Beatrix asked sheepishly. "No," Amelia murmured, gathering her close and pressing her lips to her sister's unruly dark curls. "We'll keep this between the three of us. Poppy and I will take care of everything, dear."
"All right. Thank you."
Beatrix relaxed and nestled against her with a sigh.
"I only hope you can do it without getting caught."
"Of course we can,"
Poppy said brightly.
"Don't you worry for one minute."
"Problem solved," Amelia added. And above Beatrix's head, Amelia and Poppy looked at each other in shared panic. Chapter 10.
"I don't know why Beatrix does these things,"
Poppy said the next morning, as Amelia held the ribbons of the barouche. They were on their way to Stony Cross Manor, with the stolen objects secreted in the pockets of their best day gowns.
"I'm certain she doesn't mean to,"
Amelia replied, her forehead furrowed with worry. "If it was intentional, Beatrix would steal things she truly wanted, like hair ribbons or gloves or candy, and she wouldn't confess afterward." She sighed. "It seems to happen when there's been a significant change in her life, when mother and father died, and when Leo and Wynne fell ill, and now when we've uprooted ourselves and moved to Hampshire. We'll just smooth this over as best we can, and try to ensure that Beatrix is in a calm and serene atmosphere."
"There is no such thing as calm and serene in our household,"
Poppy said glumly.
"Oh, Amelia, why must our family be so odd?"
"We're not odd." Poppy battered her hands in a dismissive gesture.
"Odd people never think they're odd."
"I'm perfectly ordinary," Amelia protested.
"Ha!"
Amelia glanced at her in surprise. "Why in heaven's name would you say ha to that?"
"You try to manage everything and everyone, and you don't trust anyone outside the family. You're like a porcupine. No one can get past the quills."
"Well, I like that," Amelia said indignantly. "Being compared to a large, prickly rodent,
when I've decided to spend the rest of my entire life looking after the family.
No one's asked that of you.
Someone has to do it, and I'm the oldest Hathaway.
Leo's the oldest.
I'm the oldest sober Hathaway.
That still doesn't mean you have to martyr yourself.
I'm not a martyr. I'm merely being responsible. And you're ungrateful.
Do you want gratitude or a husband? Personally, I'd take the husband.
I don't want a husband. They bickered all the way to Stony Cross Manor. By the time they arrived, they were both cross and surly. However, as a footman came to assist them out, they pasted full smiles on their faces and linked tense arms as they walked to the front door. They waited in the entrance hall as the butler went to announce their arrival. To Amelia's vast relief, he showed them to the parlour and informed them that Lady Westcliff would be with them directly. Venturing farther into the airy parlour, with its vases of fresh flowers and satinwood furniture and light blue silk upholstery, and the cheerful blaze in the white marble fireplace, Poppy exclaimed,
"Oh, it's so pretty in here, and it smells so lovely. And look how the windows sparkle."
Amelia was silent, but she couldn't help agreeing. Seeing this immaculate parlour, so far removed from the dust and squalor of Ramsay House, made her feel guilty and sullen. "Don't take off your bonnet," she said as Poppy untied her ribbons. "You're supposed to leave it on during a formal call."
"Only in town," Poppy argued. "In the country, etiquette is more relaxed, and I hardly think Lady Westcliff would mind."
A woman's voice came from the doorway. "Mind what?" It was Lady Westcliff, her slender form clad in a pink gown, her dark hair gathered at the back of her head in shining curls. Her smile was wrought of mischief and easy charm. She held hands with a dark-haired toddler in a blue dress, a miniature version of herself, with big, round eyes the colour of gingerbread.
"My lady."
Amelia and Poppy both bowed. Deciding to be frank, Amelia said,
"Lady Westcliff, we were just debating whether or not we could remove our bonnets."
"Good God, don't bother with formality," Lady Westcliff exclaimed, coming in with the child. "Off with the bonnets, by all means. And do call me Lillian. This is my daughter, Merritt. She and I are having a bit of playtime before her morning nap."
"I hope we're not interrupting,"
Poppy began apologetically. "Not at all. If you can tolerate our romping during your visit, we're more than happy to have you. I've sent for tea." Before long, they were all chatting easily. Merritt quickly lost all vestige of shyness and showed them her favourite doll named Annie, and a collection of pebbles and leaves from her pocket. Lady Westcliff, Lillian, was an openly affectionate and playful mother, showing no compunction about kneeling on the floor to look for fallen pebbles beneath the table. Lillian's interactions with the child were quite unusual for an aristocratic household. Children were hardly ever brought out to see visitors, unless it was a brief presentation, accompanied by a pat on the head and a quick departure. Most women of the Countess's exalted position wouldn't see their own offspring more than once or twice a day, leaving the majority of child-rearing to the nanny and nursery-maids. "I can't help wanting to see her," Lillian explained candidly, "so the nursery servants have learned to tolerate my interference." When the tea-tray arrived, Annie the doll was propped up on the settee between Poppy and Merritt. The little girl pressed the edge of her teacup against the doll's painted mouth.
"Annie wants more sugar, Mama,"
Merritt said. Lillian grinned, knowing who was going to drink the highly sweetened tea. "Tell Annie we never have more than two lumps in a cup, darling. It will make her ill."
"But she has a sweet tooth,"
the child protested. She added ominously,
"A sweet tooth and a temper."
Lillian shook her head with a "Such a headstrong doll. Be firm with her, Merritt." Poppy, who had been watching the exchange with a grin, adopted a perplexed look and wriggled slightly on the settee.
"Dear me, I do believe I'm sitting on something."
She reached behind her and produced the little wooden horse, pretending she had found it lodged between the settee cushions.
That's my horsey,
Merrit exclaimed, her small fingers closing around the object.
I thought he'd run away.
Thank goodness, Lillian said. Horsey is one of Merritt's favorite toys. The entire household has been searching for it.
Amelia's smile wavered as she met Poppy's gaze, both of them wondering if it had been discovered that other things were missing. The stolen objects, especially the silver seal, must be returned as soon as possible. She cleared her throat.
My lady, that is Lillian, if you wouldn't mind, I should like to know where the convenience is.
Oh, certainly. Shall I have a housemaid show you the way, or...
No, thank you,
Amelia said hastily. After receiving Lillian's matter-of-fact instructions, Amelia excused herself from the parlour, leaving the three of them to continue their tea. The first room she had to find was the library, where the stereoscope card and the key belonged. Recalling Beatrix's description of the main floor plan, Amelia hurried along the quiet hallway. She slowed her pace as she saw a maid sweeping the carpet and tried to look as if she knew where she was going. The maid stopped sweeping and stood aside respectfully as she passed. Rounding a corner, Amelia found an open door revealing a large library with upper and lower galleries. Better yet, it was empty. She rushed inside and saw a stereoscope on the massive library table. There was a wooden box nearby, stuffed with cards just like the one in her pocket. Tucking the card in with the others, she hurried out of the library, pausing only to insert the key into the empty lock case of the door. Only one task left. She had to find Lord Westcliff's private study and return the silver seal. The weight of it bounced uncomfortably against her leg as she walked.
"Please don't let Lord Westcliff be there," she thought desperately. "Please let it be empty. Please don't let me be caught."
Beatrix had said the study was close to the library, but the first door Amelia tried turned out to be the music room. Spying another door across the hallway, she discovered a supplies closet filled with pails, brooms, rags, and pots of wax and polish.
"Blast, blast, blast!" she muttered, rushing to another open doorway.
It was a billiards room, and it was occupied by a half-dozen gentlemen involved in a game. Amelia stopped, colour flaring in her face. Two of the men noticed her and made to bow.
"Do excuse me,"
she murmured, and fled. To her dismay, one of them left the room to follow her along the hallway.
"Miss Hathaway!"
At the sound of his voice, Amelia whirled to face him.
"Mr. Rowan!"
He was in his shirt sleeves, and his collar was a bit loose, as if he'd been tugging on it. His jet black hair was casually disordered, as if he'd recently dragged his fingers through the shining layers. Her heart quickened. She waited stiffly as he approached her in relaxed, fluid strides.
"Is there something I can help you with?"
he asked politely.
"Have you lost your way?"
Abandoning caution in favour of expediency, Amelia seized a fold of his rolled-up sleeve.
"Do you know where Lord Westcliff's study is?"
"Yes, of course."
"Show me."
He looked at her with a quizzical smile.
"Why?"
"There is no time to explain. Just take me there now, please. Let's hurry."
Obligingly, he led her across the hallway, two doors down, into a small, rosewood-panelled room. A gentleman's study. The only ornamentation was a row of rectangular stained-glass windows along one wall. Here was where Marcus, Lord Westcliff, conducted most of his estate business. Rowan closed the door behind them. Fumbling in her pocket, Amelia retrieved the heavy silver seal.
"Where does this go?"
"On the right side of his desk, near the inkwell,"
Rowan said.
"How did you come by it?"
"I'll explain later. I beg you, don't tell anyone."
She went to place the silver seal on the desk.
"I only hope he didn't notice it was missing."
"Why would you want it in the first place?"
Rowan asked idly.
"Resorting to forgery, are we?"
"Forgery?"
Amelia turned pale. A letter in Westcliff's name, sealed with his family emblem, would be a powerful instrument indeed.
What other interpretation could be drawn from the borrowing of the sterling seal?
Oh, no, I wouldn't have. That is, I didn't want...
She was interrupted by the heart-stopping sound of the doorknob turning. In that one instant, she was pierced with simultaneous anguish and resignation. It was over. She had been so close, and now she'd been caught, and God knew what the repercussions would be. There was no way to explain her presence in Westcliff's office other than to divulge Beatrix's problem, which would bring shame on the family and ruin the girl's future in polite society. A pet lizard was one thing, but thievery was another matter entirely. All these thoughts flashed through Amelia's mind in one searing mass, but as she stiffened and waited for the axe to fall, Rowan came to her in two long strides, and before Amelia could move or think or even breathe, he had jerked her full length against him and pulled her head to his. He kissed her with an indecent frankness that sent her reeling. His arms were firm around her, keeping her steady while his mouth caught hers at just the right angle. Her hands moved in tentative objection, her palms encountering the tough muscles of his chest, the catch of his shirt buttons. He was the only solid thing in a kaleidoscopic world, his body strong, foreign, and yet intensely familiar. The way he had kissed her before, she had relived it 1,000 times in her dreams. She just hadn't realized it until now. Graceful, masculine fingers cupped around her neck and jaw, turning her face upward. The tips of his fingers found the delicate skin behind her ears, where it met the silken edge of her hairline. And all the while he continued to fill her with concentrated fire, until the inside of her mouth prickled sweetly, and her legs wobbled beneath her. His mouth lifted, his breath a hot caress against her damp lips. He turned his head as he spoke to whoever had entered the room.
"I beg your pardon, my lord. We wanted a moment of privacy."
Amelia turned crimson as she followed his gaze to the doorway, where Lord Westcliff stood with an unfathomable expression. An electric moment passed, while Westcliff appeared to marshal his thoughts. His gaze moved to Amelia's flushed face, then back to Rowan's. A smile flickered in his dark eyes.
"I intend to return in approximately a half hour. It would probably be best if my study were vacated by then."
Giving them a courteous nod, he took his leave. As soon as the door closed behind him, Amelia dropped her forehead to Rowan's shoulder with a groan. She would have pulled away, but she didn't trust her knees to hold.
"Why did you do that?"
He didn't look at all repentant.
"I had to come up with a reason for both of us to be in here. It seemed the most expedient option."
Amelia shook her head slowly, still resting her forehead against him. The dry sweetness of his scent reminded her of a sun-warmed meadow.
"Do you think he'll tell anyone?"
"No,"
he said immediately, reassuring her.
"Westcliff isn't given to gossip. He won't say a word to anyone except..."
"Except?"
"Lady Westcliff. He'll probably tell her."
Amelia considered that, thinking perhaps it wasn't so terrible. Lady Westcliff didn't seem like the kind of person who would condemn her for this. The Countess seemed highly tolerant of scandalous behaviour.
"Of course," Rowan continued, "if Lady Westcliff knows, there's a high probability she'll tell Lady St. Vincent, who's due to arrive with Lord St. Vincent by the end of the week. And since Lady St. Vincent tells her husband everything, he'll know about it too. Other than that, no one will find out. Unless..."
Her head jerked upward like a string puppet's. "Unless what?"
"Unless Lord St. Vincent mentions it to Mr. Hunt, who would undoubtedly tell his wife, Mrs. Hunt, and then basically everyone would find out."
"Oh, no, I can't bear it."
He gave her an alert glance.
"Why? Because you were caught kissing a gypsy?"
"No, because I'm not the kind of woman who is caught kissing anyone. I don't have rendezvous. When everyone finds out, I'll have no dignity left. No reputation. No... What are you smiling at?"
"You... I wouldn't have expected such melodrama from you.
That annoyed Amelia, who was not the kind of woman who indulged in theatrics. She wedged her arms more firmly between them.
My reaction is perfectly reasonable, considering...
You're not bad at it.
She blinked in confusion.
Melodrama?
No. Kissing. With a little practice, you'd be exceptional. But you need to relax.
I don't want to relax. I don't want to... Oh, dear Lord.
He had bent his head to her throat, searching for the visible thrum of her pulse. A light, hot shock went through her.
Don't do that,
she said weakly, but he was insistent, his mouth wickedly soft, and her breath hitched as she felt the brush of his tongue. Her hands shot to his muscle-banked shoulders.
Mr. Rowan, you mustn't!
This is how to kiss, Amelia.
He cradled her head in his palms, deftly tilting it to the side.
Noses go here.
A disorienting brush of his mouth, a wash of sensual heat.
You taste like sugar and tea.
I have to go back.
Not yet.
His thumb passed over her kiss-heated lips, urging them to part.
Let me in, Amelia, he whispered.
Never in her life had she thought a man would say something so outrageous to her, and if the words were improper, the gleam in his eyes was positively immolating.
I'm a spinster.
She offered the word as if it were a talisman. A covert smile deepened the corners of his mouth.
That's not going to keep you safe from me.
She tried to turn away from him, but his hands guided her face back to his.
I can't seem to leave you alone. In fact, I'm reconsidering my entire policy on spinsters.
Before she could ask what his policy was, his mouth possessed hers again, while his fingers caressed the taut edge of her jaw, coaxing her to relax. The taste of him was so compelling that she found herself yielding, letting him search her with slow, erotic forays of his tongue. The kisses were melting sweet, like boiling candy syrup, soaking into her, sinking deep and spreading and simmering. Her legs turned unsteady, and he gathered her into the firm support of his body. His hands moved in restive paths over her back and shoulders, while his lips broke from hers to explore the soft slope of her neck. He found a place that made her writhe, teasing gently until she gasped and twisted against him. Rowan's head lifted. His eyes glowed as if brimstone were contained within the dark-rimmed irises. He spoke slowly, as if he were collecting words like fallen leaves from the ground.
This is probably a bad idea.
Amelia nodded shakily.
Yes, Mr. Rowan.
His fingertips teased a fresh surge of colour to the surface of her cheeks.
My name is Cam.
I can't call you that.
Why not?
You know why,
came her shaky reproach. A long breath was neatly rifted as she felt his mouth descend to her cheek, exploring the heat-polished skin.
What does it mean?
My name. It's the Romany word for son.
Amelia could scarcely think. As in, the offspring of a father, or in the sky?
Sky.
He moved to the arch of her eyebrow, kissing the outward tip.
Did you know a gypsy has three names?
She shook her head slowly, while his mouth slid across her forehead. He pressed a warm veil of words against her skin.
The first is a secret name a mother whispers into her child's ear at birth. The second is a tribal name used only by other gypsies. The third is the name we use with non-Roma.
His scent was all around her, spare and fresh and delicious.
What is your tribal name?
He smiled slightly, the shape of his mouth a burning motif against her cheek.
I can't tell you. I don't know you well enough yet.
Yet? The tantalizing promise embedded in that word shortened her breath,
Let me go,
she whispered.
Yes, just one more. Just...
He bent and took her mouth hungrily. Suffused with pleasure, Amelia groped for his hair, finding acute satisfaction in the slide of heavy silk through her fingers. As he felt her touch him, he gave a low mutter of encouragement. The pattern of his breath changed, roughened, his kisses turning hard and languorous. He took what she offered, more, sinking his tongue deeper, gathering sensation. And she responded, until her soul was scorched at the edges, and her thoughts had vanished like sparks leaping from a bonfire. Abruptly, Rowan took his mouth from hers and held her tightly, too tightly, against the hard contours of his body. She felt herself straining in a subtle pendulum sway, needing friction, pressure, release. He kept her still, holding her close while she simmered and trembled and ached. Rowan's grip eased. She was released by gradual degrees, until he was finally able to push her away completely.
Pardon, he eventually said.
She saw the hard ripple of his swallow, the daze of heat in his eyes.
I don't usually have such a difficult time stopping.
Amelia nodded blindly and wrapped her arms around herself. She wasn't aware of her foot's nervous tapping until Rowan came to her and slid one of his feet beneath her skirts to still her drumming toes.
Hummingbird, he whispered, you'd better go now. If you don't, I'll end up compromising you in ways you never knew were possible.
Amelia was never quite certain how she returned to the parlour without getting lost. She moved as if through the layers of a dream. Reaching the settee where Poppy sat, Amelia accepted another cup of tea and smiled at little Merritt, who was fishing around in her own cup for a chunk of dropped sugar biscuit, and responded noncommittally to Lillian's suggestion that the entire Hathaway family join them on a picnic at Week's End.
I do wish we could have accepted her invitation, Poppy said wistfully on the way home. But I suppose that would be asking for trouble, since Leah would probably be objectionable, and Beatrix would steal something.
And there's far too much for us to do at Ramsay House, Amelia added, feeling distracted and distant. Only one thought was clear in her mind. Cam Rowan would return to London soon. For her own sake, and perhaps his as well, she would have to avoid Stony Cross Park until he was gone. Perhaps it was because they were all weary of cleaning, repairing, and organizing, but the entire Hathaway family was in a desultory mood that evening. Everyone but Leo gathered around the hearth in one of the downstairs rooms, lounging, while Wynne read aloud from a Dickens novel. Mary Penn occupied a distant corner of the room, near the family but not quite part of it, listening intently. No doubt Wynne could have read names from an insurance register, and he would have found it enthralling. Poppy was busy with needlework, stitching a pair of men's slippers with bright wool threads, while Beatrix played solitaire on the floor near the hearth. Noticing the way her youngest sister was riffling through the cards, Amelia laughed.
Beatrix, she said after Wynne had finished a chapter, why in heaven's name would you cheat at solitaire? You're playing against yourself.
Then there's no one to object when I cheat.
It's not whether you win, but how you win that's important, Amelia said.
I've heard that before, and I don't agree at all. It's much nicer to win.
Poppy shook her head over her embroidery.
Beatrix, you are positively shameless.
And a winner,
Beatrix said with satisfaction, laying down the exact card she wanted. Where did we go wrong? Amelia asked of no one in particular. Wynne smiled.
Her pleasure's a few, dear. A creative game of solitaire isn't going to hurt anyone.
I suppose not. Amelia was about to say more, but she was diverted by a cool waft of air that slipped around her ankles and turned her toes numb. She shivered and pulled her knitted blue shawl more snugly around herself.
My, it's chilly in here.
You must be sitting in a draught,
Poppy said in concern.
Come sit by me, Amelia. I'm much closer to the fire.
Thank you, but I think I'll go to bed now. Still shivering, Amelia yawned. Good night, everyone. She left as Beatrix asked Wynne to read one more chapter. As Amelia walked along the hallway, she passed a small room that, as far as they had been able to tell, had been intended as a gentleman's room. It featured an alcove that was just large enough for a billiards table, and a dingy painting of a hunting scene on one wall. A large, overstuffed chair was positioned between the windows, its velvet nap eroded. Light from a standing lamp slid across the floor in a diluted wash. Leo was drowsing in the chair, one arm hanging loosely over the side. An empty bottle stood on the floor near the chair, casting a spear-like shadow to the other side of the room. Amelia would have continued on her way, but something about her brother's undefended posture caused her to stop. He slept with his head slumped over one shoulder, lips slightly parted, just as he had in childhood. With his face wiped clean of anger and grief, he looked young and vulnerable. She was reminded of the gallant boy he had once been, and her heart contracted with pity. Venturing into the room, Amelia was shocked by the abrupt change of temperature, the biting air. It was far colder in here than it was outside, and it wasn't her imagination. She could see the white puffs of her breath. Shivering, she drew closer to her brother. The coldness was concentrated around him, turning so bitter that it made her lungs hurt to breathe. As she hovered over his prone form, she was swamped in a feeling of bleakness, a sorrow beyond tears. Leo. His face was grey, his lips dry and blue, and when she touched his cheek there was no trace of warmth. Leo. No response. Amelia shook him, pushed hard at his chest, took his stiff face in her hands. As she did so, she felt some invisible force pulling at her. She held on doggedly, knotting her fists in the loose folds of his shirt. Leo, wake up! To her infinite relief, he stirred and gasped, and his lashes flickered upward. The irises of his eyes were as pale as ice. His palms came to her shoulders, and he muttered groggily,
I'm awake. Jesus, don't scream, you're making enough noise to wake the dead.
For a moment, I thought that was exactly what I was doing.
Amelia half collapsed onto the arm of the chair, her nerves thrilling unpleasantly. The chill was receding now.
Oh, Leo, you were so still and pale. I've seen livelier-looking corpses.
Her brother rubbed his eyes.
I'm only a bit tap-hackled, not dead.
You wouldn't wake up.
I didn't want to.
He paused, looking troubled. His tone was soft and wondering.
I was dreaming. Such vivid dreams.
About what?
He wouldn't answer.
About Laura,
Amelia persisted. His face closed, deep lines weathering the surface like fissures made by the expansion of ice inside rock.
I told you never to mention her name to me.
Yes, because you didn't want to be reminded of her. But it doesn't matter, Leo. You never stop thinking about her, whether you hear her name or not.
I'm not going to talk about her.
Well, it's fairly obvious avoidance isn't working.
Her mind spun desperately with the question of what tack to take, how best to reach him. She tried determination.
I won't let you fall to pieces, Leo.
The look he gave her made it clear that determination had been a bad choice.
Some day, he said with cold pleasantness, you may be forced to acknowledge there are some things beyond your control. If I want to go to pieces, I'll do it without asking your bloody permission.
She tried sympathy next.
Leo, I know what you've gone through since Laura died. I'm so sorry.
No, you don't. You've never loved anyone that way.
Amelia blinked, taken aback.
I've loved many people in my life.
Not the way we're speaking of. You don't understand anything.
I know that other people have recovered from loss, and they've gone on to find happiness again.
There's no more happiness,
Leo said roughly.
There's no peace in any damn corner of my life. She took it all with her. For pity's sake, Amelia, go meddle in someone else's affairs, and leave me the hell alone.